All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Yep, and we got a packed show for you today.
At the back end of the show, we're going to be listening to an excerpt of a speech by Bob Avakian. And it's part of a film called BA Speaks, Revolution Nothing Less. All that. All questions that are very, very relevant for the world we're living in today. All right, and so you'll be, I'm sure you're going to really have your minds blown with that one. So you don't want to miss that. Before that, we'll be talking with Miriam Griffin, who's a postdoctoral fellow at UC Davis, and she's the co-editor of a new book from AK Press called We Will Not Be Silenced, The Academic Repression of Israel's Critics.
And opening the show up, I'm very pleased to welcome back to the show Andy Z. And we're talking with Andy about what the hell has been going on over these last few days, especially with the firing of FBI Director James Comey. What do we got to think about there? What do we got to know about that? Andy, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
All right, let's jump in, man. In the wake of Trump suddenly firing Comey, it seems the whole society has been turned on its ear. And everybody's responding to this development in different ways. And you know, some see a constitutional crisis. Bill Moyers is calling for a special prosecutor. All these people are getting out and saying things. What do you make of this latest development with Trump?
Well, Michael, it's a very serious development. What do I make of this development with the firing of the FBI director who was conducting an investigation into the Trump campaign that's probably spilling over into the actual early days of the administration, maybe even current? It's a very serious move. It's a very serious move, whether or not it's a constitutional crisis. First of all, there's no precise definition of what a constitutional crisis is. So in terms of that, that is kind of a thing of it's when people feel generally in society that the governing norms, including the constitutional norms, have been violated in some way. And certainly this approaches that kind of situation. But the most important thing that I think we all need to come to grips with is this is a further development of the Trump and Pence regime instituting and consolidating a fascist hold on society. And people should, on the one hand, take this very seriously because it is a subversion of the rule of law. It's saying that if the normal institutions of government are proceeding to investigate this regime, and they're not loyal to Donald Trump and his administration, Jeff Sessions, the whole lot of them, then they will be fired. And it's a demand for complete loyalty. And that demand is indicative of the kind of fascist development that we're seeing step by step almost every day. And we can walk through some of what they've done just in the last week to get a handle on that. So this is a very serious turn of events that we need to respond to.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about that over the last week, the last 3 months even, what Trump has already made. He's made significant developments towards full-out fascism since he came into office. But there's actually been a lot of stuff that he's done in the recent period that have actually been sort of like steamrolling.
Yeah, this is the case. You know, just on the front of the rule of law, which actually gets to the essence, the actual essence of what fascism is when it fully takes power. And just before getting deeply into what he's actually done, it's important that people recognize that fascism is the exercise of a blatant dictatorship by the ruling class, the capitalist class. They're where they rule through relying on open terror and violence and trampling what are supposed to be civil and legal rights, wielding the power of the state and then mobilizing groups of fanatical thugs, which we see they're doing in Berkeley. And all this against the masses of people who they identify as enemies and undesirables or dangerous to society. This is a definition that's on the website, revcom.us. And we can see that they've taken steps. Now, two things. One, they've not yet fully succeeded in this. There's opposition, but this opposition now needs to take to the streets and get out there and put the kind of pressure and movement on society that this is unacceptable. This is an extraordinary moment that requires people to act in extraordinary ways. There's nothing normal about this in terms of the function of society, which day to day for most of the oppressed people in this country, and anybody who steps out of bounds with real backing is a society full of oppression and exploitation. But what you have to recognize is this is extraordinary. So in the last week, there have been fascistic laws, really draconian laws, passed in Texas and Oklahoma on the federal level. Jeff Sessions has just announced he's going to increase calling for all federal prosecutors to go after people with the maximum sentence allowed, same time, the Trump administration has compiled a list of 25 really reactionary judges to pack the courts, and this fascism has been under development for some time with the Republican Party, which has been nothing other than a fascist party for many years now, not approving any kind of federal judgeships. And so now they've got all these vacancies, which they want to pack with loyal judges. At the same time, the administration has said that they would basically, for them, the First Amendment is up for consideration by passing libel laws such that they would be able to sue the press for publishing the truth about or anything that's disloyal to the Trump administration, an assault on this essential premises of this kind of bourgeois democracy. These are the kinds of things that have happened just in the last couple of weeks. And this is just on the question of the rule of law. If we were to walk through this on the environment, on any number of questions, immigration, the health laws, all this, you can see that it's a full-out assault by essentially a regime of thugs intent on imposing an entirely different norm on society with tremendous impact in the world, including, do not forget, while all this is going on, that he's still playing nuclear brinkmanship with North Korea and threatening even intensified war within in the Mideast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. You know, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Andy Z. And Andy is one of the initiators of RefuseFascism.org, and he's also a spokesperson for Revolution Books in New York City. Now, Andy, you know, one of the things, as I was thinking about it, you spoke a little bit to this thing about the constitutional crisis and all, but there's also something that comes up from, I just remember, you know, reading this, that anywhere there's a development of something like where people are thinking like, well, this is a major upheaval in society. This could actually break some things loose. There's been a lot of talk as well of an approaching legitimacy crisis. And I want to know what you make of that, because there's a lot tied up in that in terms of the both what's going on now and what's possible out of this.
Well, yeah, there is a question of legitimacy that's hanging over society. And the question of, does the government have the right to do what they're doing? Do people see what their actions are as legitimate? And there's even a question of, in a situation like we're in now, where there's tremendous contention within the ruling class between the Democrats on the one hand, who kind of represent what has been the dominant form of oppression in this country for some time, but which allows for a certain form of dissent and working out of ideas within their ranks, and also allows for a certain scope of political activity among the people, and certainly to try and gain consent is the principal thing, but also some room for people to raise questions. They want to wipe all that. So there's a question of illegitimacy and legitimacy, even within the ruling class. And in fact, for the Trump regime, for them, and this is very historically relevant to the experiences in previous fascist societies, the Democratic Party is illegitimate, thus the calls for to somebody like Hillary Clinton, who's no friend of the people of the world, to lock her up, to threaten to jail her, to even threaten assassination. So that the question of legitimacy is hanging in the air, and when you go fire the person who is charged with investigating your campaign for possible collusion with, in this case, Russia, but you're under investigation, to fire them essentially for being disloyal, this raises the question of, will there be the rule of law, or will this be the rule of Donald Trump and Mike Pence and a regime, Jeff Sessions, Bannon, all these people, and what they say goes? And, you know, this is the kind of thing in the world we live in today that is gaining ascendancy, yes, in places like Russia, but also look at who Trump lauds as rulers that he admires, say Duterte in the Philippines, Erdogan in Turkey, Sisi in Egypt. This is what he's looking to as a certain, and there's a movement among this that times are such that there's this kind of rule that people see as necessary. So that poses a question of what has previously seen as legitimate, is that being upturned? And the question is, who will resolve that crisis? And what we in Refuse Fascism say, many people don't have to assume my views on the necessity for revolution, that the whole system is bankrupt, but people in Refuse Fascism is that point of view is that the people have to be out in the streets on this. It's the people who will set a different dynamic rather than relying on the Democrats who are trying to, on the one hand, oppose this, but oppose this through trying to themselves come back to ascendancy in 2018. And, we have to recognize that there isn't time for that, that Trump is moving very fast, and as he encounters contradictions, this could get very, very sharp, including where there's an outright legitimacy crisis within the ruling class, and it needs to be one between the ruling class and the people themselves. This is something we really need to be pushing on, including that this Trump, as a central unifying thing for all the people, we need to drive out the Trump-Pence regime. Nobody else is going to do this but the people themselves. Only the people creating the kind of political crisis that you saw at the beginning of Arab Spring or in South Korea this past winter could create the kind of crisis where those in power would decide to jettison not just Donald Trump, but Mike Pence too. And people are letting this guy off the hook. He is really dangerous. In fact, in some ways, just as dangerous as Trump. So this is something we have to, people have to be talking about and getting inside and not just relying on the normal processes, including of impeachment, but to be moving to themselves demand. A whole lot of them need to be gone. They're illegitimate. Why? Because they're fascists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And, you know, and the thing that I was thinking about, and we won't have time to get into this in any depth, but I kept thinking about people referring to Nixon's Saturday Night Massacre many years ago in the 1970s, and firing Archibald Cox, who was spearheading the investigation of some of the illegal things done by Nixon's people. And I kept thinking about people referring to that and looking at that as sort of a model in certain sense. I've seen people referring to, you know, well, how we can figure out what's going on or what to do in relation to that. And you're thinking about just some of the things you've just been saying, the stakes, what's going on in the world today, and the stakes involved are so much higher, so much more intense than they were back then, that this is a whole different ballgame now.
Yeah, well, look, that was a serious crisis. That was a serious crisis, and there was a question of the war that was still continuing and dragging on, and it was a crisis not only between the people and the government, but actually at that point, there was a big crisis in ruling circles. The U.S. is being largely discredited in lots of places in the world, especially because of the prosecution of the Vietnam War and the things that have been revealed about Nixon. But you did have a situation where at a certain point when the pressure was on, including after that firing of Archibald Cox, and that there were wiser heads in the ruling class, and Nixon himself eventually fell on the sword for the greater good and resigned. But what's different today, and where in fact the stakes are higher, is that there is a very tumultuous world situation, and that there's a tremendous split in society, a huge divide with now, and this is the most salient point, there is a full-out fascist regime in power that is moving step by step to consolidate fascism. And that is extremely dangerous. How long it will take them, what kind of incident they would need to really dramatically clamp down even further, I don't know. But what we do know is this is what they're doing. The entire regime is this way. There's no positive within all of this that people can grab onto. And they're going up against an extremely disorganized and weak opposition, an opposition that has no bearings within their own strata. And the people themselves are not yet conscious of what needs to be done and what it is we're actually fighting. So the danger here is extreme because in this situation, you've got a fascist regime with a lunatic in charge of it, which is actually almost by definition in these fascist countries. And he's got his finger on the nuclear trigger. So you face an extremely dangerous situation here in that sense, because we're facing fascism on the one hand and the stakes internationally and the fact that he has threatened to break a consensus, if you will, among ruling powers to not use nuclear weapons, not that it wasn't previously a danger, but this is on another scale. It makes this all the more serious that this is a kind of thing right now that's existential, which means the existence of humanity is at stake, and for two reasons. One, as I'm pointing out, the danger of nuclear war, and two, because he's prepared at a tipping point for the environment to discard all protections for the environment and to try to reverse or at least slow down some of the effects of climate change. And he's already begun this process. So we face a very serious thing. If there's ever a time to change your life and get out in the streets and get with refusefascism.org, today is it.
And that gets us to the question, the last question we're going to be able to talk about. Basically, you know, there's a lot of different ideas about how to actually approach this, what people should be doing. But Refuse Fascism argues for a very different approach, but one that I think actually is a very definitely needed, necessary approach if actually humanity is going to come out of this. Let's talk about this. This is a pivotal moment, and what people do or don't do is going to be decisive in many ways. So what's up?
Well, what's up is this has to be the time when people who are alarmed, who are outraged, who can't even believe this is happening, need to take the streets and to, in a certain sense, to understand what's happening and to get out there and start be protesting every day, not let these people get away with anything. It's great that people are going to town halls, but it can't, and they're raising hell. There's been some inspiring things just in the last couple of days, particularly focused around the health care bill. But that by itself is insufficient. It won't deal with that the situation. The system can absorb that. Trump can absorb that. Hitler absorbed a lot, to be frank. But people have to understand that to resolve this, the regime has to be gone, because they do hold all the levers of the essential elements of state power. This is one of the things why the Comey thing is so indicative. I think probably a lot of your listeners know full well that the FBI is no friend of the people. On the other hand, firing him at this time shows that what they're going to do is clear out every agency of repression of anybody who has any sense of principle at all in that, even if they're their principles, and enforce, bring in people and utilize the people who want to simply clamp down on folks. And he can, you know, yesterday they announced they're appointing this election commission to investigate fraud in the elections. This is just a smokescreen to even further eliminate the right to vote for particularly Black, Latino prisoners and all kinds of people they see in opposition to them. You may not have a chance to vote again. So this is why Refuse Fascism is saying that only the people out in the streets creating the kind of, ultimately we're aiming for millions of people to be in the streets day after day, night after night, creating the kind of crisis you saw in Seoul, Korea, or in Tahrir Square in Egypt, where the question is, whither society? And that the stakes of which would be, this regime has to go, it's illegitimate. Anything short of that still gives too much initiative and a great deal of initiative to the Trump-Pence regime to be able to, in a single act or in a series of very rapid acts, to eliminate the potential for dissent, opposition, and they will, in fact, and you can see this already, cower their opposition within the halls of power. So this is why only the people can solve this, and now is the time. A lot of people will say to us, I have one more point to make, that you're being premature. It's too early to call it fascism. It's too early to call it authoritarian. Well, some are going that way. Well, see, here's the point. Better early than late, because when it can become too late when you're dealing with fascism. What, do you want to wait till there's a Reichstag fire and they pass these kinds of laws that make it difficult, if not impossible, to protest? Look at what they just did in Oklahoma last week. Then it becomes, the stakes are extremely high. Now is the time to start the kind of movement that is undeniable. And yes, this is not where the majority of people are at right now, but they need to be and they can be if those who see what's actually coming down start to act and not just gripe, not just get on the internet and rightfully protest, righteously protest one or another act of the regime, but to unite together around the one thing that really needs to be done, which is to drive the regime out, even as people are pursuing their protest around individual policies and acts of the regime.
All right, Andy Z, thank you very much for joining us today, man.
All right, thanks a lot, Mike.
Yeah, look forward to having you back. All right, Andy, thank you very much, man.
Okay, good.
Talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. Welcome back. That was Al Intifada Vas Jabal Al, and it's from the Palestinian Student Carmel Group. I'm really pleased to be bringing onto the show one of the editors of We Will Not Be Silenced, The Academic Repression of Israel's Critics, all right? And the co-editor of the book, along with William Robinson, the co-editor of the book is Maryam S. Griffin. Maryam, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this because I want you to get have as much of a chance to talk as we can possibly do, okay? You open your book stating that there's a new worldwide campaign in support of Palestinian freedom struggle. And at the center of this is in the U.S. and it's on college campuses. That might surprise a lot of people. Tell us about that.
Okay, yeah. So in fact, this is a campaign that I have had the pleasure of watching develop from my time as an undergraduate student at UCLA, which I began maybe 2 weeks after the attacks of September 11th. So I was in college at a time when there was increasing hostility towards Arabs and Muslims, Middle Easterners, and also any causes that are seen to be affiliated with those things, including, of course, Palestine. And so, you know, I was involved in different political organizing, but there was really, there was a resurgence of it at that time, but there was also a whole lot of repression. And so, you know, Students for Justice in Palestine was a very small group on campus at that time. Actually, I'm sorry, it wasn't even its own group. It was subsumed under a different group. There were a lot of smear campaigns and attempts to discredit people who were interested in Palestine. So that's 2001. I then went to law school at UCLA and went to grad school at UC Santa Barbara. And so I've stayed in California. Now I'm a postdoc at UC Davis. I've stayed in California and I've stayed on college campuses. And I've had the pleasure of seeing that these student organizations are becoming stronger. They're becoming more organized. They're connecting with each other. They're sharing resources. They are mounting campaigns, most notably the move to push universities to divest from companies that are in one way or another involved in the Israeli occupation in the West Bank or involved in settlement operations in the West Bank. And so this really has, I've seen exactly how this has grown and has become stronger, in part because people are becoming more aware of what is actually happening in Palestine and the conditions of Palestinian life, not only in the West Bank, but in all of historic Palestine. And we have to give credit where credit is due, and that is a large part due to, you know, Palestinian efforts to connect to the international civil society to sort of bypass these failed negotiations of government officials, both Palestinian government officials, Israeli government officials, and U.S. government officials, and to say they're not working in our best interest. We need to go to other people of conscience around the world and appeal to them directly. And so I see the success particularly among university students who have access to international information via their professors and via the internet, of course, and via some media, that they are learning more and are able to again, build their knowledge base and then build their community organizing networks.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that I want to ask you about, because exactly building off of that point, is that there is a need for people to step up and do this. And at the same time, they're not just stepping up in a vacuum. There's actually some very, very contentious things going on. There's activists have to go up against a very powerful Israel lobby. That actually is dominating a lot of what happens on the campuses to a certain extent. I mean, there's changes in that now, and there's actually a fighting back and forth between the students and the people there and then these forces that are actually coming out and doing some really, I mean, reading your book, just seeing the things that people are up against in relation to what's being put out against them. It makes you really admire the people that are doing it, but two, it also opens your eyes up about the nature of all this.
Yes, absolutely. And I think you're right. I think for me, what I see is that this repression has been happening for decades and decades. And, you know, what I'm seeing now is more pushback and more fighting. So to me, it appears that the tide is turning, if not slowly. So all of the vicious attacks that are well resourced and well coordinated against people who are speaking for rights or for justice for Palestinians, I see that as sort of the last desperate throes of people who are really on the wrong side of history and who are coming to feel very uncomfortable about that position. And so they're desperately trying to just silence these opinions, just silence even the notion of Palestinian humanity because it's too disturbing in terms of what they believe. So I definitely see the turning tide, but of course there are these concerted attacks. And so one of the consequences of these concerted attacks, a big campaign of fear that depends a lot on self-censorship or self-silencing. And so I think what was so important for me in being involved with this book is not only to present the firsthand testimonies of academics, whether they be undergraduate students, graduate students, or faculty in various roles, lecturers or tenured faculty, to tell their story in detail of how they were attacked, and also to tell what happened after they were attacked and how they overcame, you know, whether it was the specific demands of those who sought to oppress them, whether they overcame those, or whether, unfortunately, those demands were met, but they went on to do other things. I think it is very important to put out those narratives as well to undo some of the fear-mongering that this campaign really, these repression campaigns really rely on. I know when I was a graduate student choosing a dissertation topic and decided to choose something related to Palestine and Palestinian life, I was heavily discouraged by other colleagues, by family members even, by friends. And all of the discouragement had nothing to do with whether it was an interesting topic or whether it was right for me to pursue it, but rather all of the backlash and danger I would find myself in if I did pursue a research on Palestine. I'm happy to say that I did find advisors that were very supportive of me, and so I went on ahead. But this really strikes me as one of the key problems that we need to address amongst ourselves, those, you know, again, the community of people of conscience who don't want to be fear-mongered, don't want to be intimidated by these forces. And again, that's why we chose the title for this book, We Will Not Be Silenced, and that's why we included the testimonies that we did.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Miriam Griffin, a postdoctoral fellow at UC Davis and one of the co-editors of a great book, just a really great book. It's called We Will Not Be Silenced, The Academic Repression of Israel's Critics, and it's edited by William Robinson and Miriam Griffin. Now, Miriam, tell me this. There's a couple things in your book where you talk about, and I was really intrigued by some of the students that you talk about in terms of the going up against this whole, the Israel lobby, the whole, you know, backing of U.S. imperialism in this whole thing, and what's happening in all this. And some of them, I wanted to talk about a couple of them just, and we won't be able to go deeply into it, but I think actually people need to hear some of this. I was thinking first, let's talk about UC Irvine. Because that was something that really, I don't think enough people paid enough attention to what actually happened there. Because when you're reading this in your book, it's just so, it's a cross between enraging and inspiring. You know, it's like really, really important.
Yeah. So I'm going to talk about the case, but I just want to note the reaction that you have is the reaction not only that I hope readers will have picking up this book, but also that so many of our contributors, I believe all of our contributors, in fact, and the people that I know informally who have also experienced such attacks have, which is when these forces come to try to silence them, they just become stronger advocates for Palestinian rights. And so the case of the Irvine 11, I think, is a very interesting one in terms of that in particular, because these are students who are in some ways very much more susceptible to repression campaigns. They have so much to lose. They're a little bit less in the public spotlight than established academics who have an academic community and colleagues at their universities who can rally around them. Sometimes these student activists are part of small organizations on campus, and they don't have any resources at all. Most of these students were just in Palestine organizations. And so such is the case with the Irvine 11 of students who basically decided that they were fed up with the dominant narrative of Israel attacking the Gaza Strip on rotation every 2 years as some kind of exercise in maintaining national security. And so what happened was the campus, University of California at Irvine, invited the Israeli ambassador to the U.S., Michael Oren, to give a talk. And of course, this is, you know, a mouthpiece, a propaganda mouthpiece for the Israeli government, of course. And so he's come to talk during the 2010, but he's coming to talk about a year after Israel attacks the Gaza Strip, killing something like 1,200 people in Operation Cast Lead between 2008-2009. And he's coming to, you know, do the song and dance that public officials do to try to spin this as some necessary evil. And the students had just had it. They didn't want the university to be sponsoring something like this. They didn't want the university to be giving a platform to someone who is really protecting what some argue is a slow motion genocide in the Gaza Strip. And I say that, by the way, because the Gaza Strip has been under closure, under lockdown for almost 10 years. Sorry, for more than 10 years. And so when they're put under siege and bombed and, you know, white phosphorus is dropped on them, this is a captive population that can't get away from the death and destruction. So the students went in and they protested and they interrupted the speaker. And the students were then taken under arrest, under police custody, and then later prosecuted in court for interrupting this speaker who is coming from a country that is extremely well-funded by the U.S. in particular, which sends more than $4 billion in total in aid to Israel. And so, you know, we're trying to highlight basically the imbalance of power there. These are, again, these are just student activists who are there on the power of their conscience, trying to resist this propaganda. And they are the ones who have the whole power of the state being brought onto their heads, arrested, prosecuted, this kind of thing. I think it's a really stark example of just how threatening their voices that support Palestinian freedom are mm-hmm. to this kind of establishment.
Yeah. And I wanted to get into, but we're not going to be able to, I wanted to get into a little bit more, and I encourage people to get the book and actually read all of this. And actually, I also was very, very moved by the students at Northeastern University and the kinds of things yes. that are going on up and down this country. I mean, I don't know if you followed the stuff at Fordham, where the Palestinian student group, the, I guess, I don't know whether it was a, I don't know exactly what group it was, but
it was an SJP. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. And they were denied the ability to even form an organization on the campus. This is the kind yeah. of things coming out, but people are standing up and fighting around this, and it's really important. Your book really brings this all to life, and that leads me to one last question. We're going to have to give you're going to have to be poetic and fast, okay?
Okay.
The title of your book. The title of your book is "We Will Not Be Silenced," and there's a significance to that, and I want people to hear it because I think it's extremely important. Then, now, and especially today.
Absolutely. Okay. So, very quickly, the significance of the phrase is a play on, I think, a better-known phrase, "We will not be silent," which was an important slogan for the White Rose movement, which was a nonviolent movement of students and professors in the early 1940s who were agitating against the Nazis in Germany. And their weapon of choice was the written word. And they were, you know, writing, researching, reading, talking to people to expose the horrors of Nazi ideology. And for their crimes of thinking critically, they were hunted, attacked, and ultimately some of them were killed for doing this. And so our choice of this title was really an homage to this group, which our predecessors basically, who saw the dangers of authoritarianism, of oppression, of militarism, and used their minds to resist that.
All right, Miriam Griffin, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, this is the Michael Slate Show, and we've just been speaking with Miriam Griffin, who's a postdoctoral fellow at UC Davis and also the co-editor of a new book from AK Press called "We Will Not Be Silenced: The Academic Repression of Israel's Critics." We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. Welcome back. That was Decision from Outer National, and that's all about Donald Trump. All right, so check that out. All right, now I'm very pleased to be letting you know that we're going to be listening to, in this next segment, we're going to be listening to a piece from a speech given by Bob Avakian in 2012, the end of 2012. And the piece comes from, it's out available as a video, and it's called BA Speaks Revolution Nothing Less. And this particular excerpt has to do with making revolution, and it's all about talking about a radically different and far better world as possible. We need a revolution to overcome all oppressive divisions, and we need a real revolution, not better democracy, under this system. And it's very fitting for what's going on in the world today, especially with the ascent of that fascist Trump and the rest of what's happening in relation to all that. So check this out.
In order to fully recognize the basis for this revolution and why it is possible, it is very important to understand what can be accomplished now that could not be accomplished before in the history of humanity. We have in the earlier history of this country some negative examples where different oppressed peoples were pitted against each other because they did not see and did not have a strong basis for seeing the larger picture. For example, in the context of the Civil War, you had Native American tribes on both sides of the Civil War. Some fought with the Union, but some, coming narrowly out of their own vision of their immediate circumstances, fought with the Confederacy. Or there's an experience on the other side of it. After the Civil War, once again, being constrained within a narrow framework, not seeing things broadly enough, you had a number of black soldiers who became part of the Buffalo Soldiers who went out to continue carrying out the theft of the land of the native peoples and the furthering the genocide against them, trying to earn a place for themselves within the existing framework because they didn't see the broader picture. I have to say here, I think it's very fitting that a war criminal of great proportions has taken the Buffalo Soldiers as one of his main role models and has figurines of them on his desk. I'm talking about Colin Powell, who's been a war criminal since the days of the Vietnam War. I don't have time, unfortunately, to go into his whole history as a war criminal. But he's been a war criminal since the days of the Vietnam War, and his attempts to help cover up the vicious My Lai massacre in that war, where hundreds of villagers, mainly old people and children, were slaughtered by American troops. And right up through the first war in Iraq in the 90s, up to the present time, he's been an active war criminal. So it's very fitting that his model is the Buffalo Soldiers, but it's not fitting for the masses of people. That was a tragic irony that oppressed people who just gotten out of slavery joined up to go fight other oppressed people. Or you can think about the homesteaders in this country, white soldiers who fought in the Civil War and were rewarded by giving land to the West. Whose land was it? It was the land of those very native peoples who were being driven back once again. The framework was too narrow. People's interests were too confined within the existing system to see a way for different groups of people, and oppressed people in particular, not to be pitted against each other, or people fighting a righteous fight not to end up being pitted against oppressed people. And we could go even further back into history. Let's go back to the days of early Christianity. This seems to be a theme here today. If you read the book of Acts in the Bible, you will see what Marx and Engels, the founder of the communist movement, openly acknowledged, that the principle of communist society that they formulated, from each according to their ability to each according to their needs, was actually a formulation that was taken from what was described in the book of Acts about the early Christian communities under the Roman Empire. What happened was, in those early Christian communities, at first they drew marginalized and poorer people, but then they started winning over some wealthier people from the upper classes of the Roman Empire. And as Acts describes it, when those wealthier people came, they brought with them some of their wealth, and they passed it out among the people in the Christian community, and they shared it on the basis of need. But there was a big problem here. The problem was that this wealth that these people were bringing was all based on an empire of plunder, exploitation, and oppression. That's where the wealth came from in the first place. So even though within these little enclaves, these little marginal parts of society in these early Christian communities, they were practicing this kind of good principle, it was all in the overall framework and on the foundation of terrible plunder, exploitation, and oppression. And I was thinking about this when I was reading about an experience of the Occupy movement in New York recently. At the period of the upsurge, when it began in New York in Zuccotti Park, when people were occupying that park, this struck a chord with a lot of people. Now, we know there were limitations to this movement, one of which I'm going to speak to right now, but it had many, many positive aspects to it. Most of all, the people were standing up and fighting and breaking out of a certain framework, even with a lot of conflicting and contradictory ideas. And it struck a chord, and a lot of people wanted to support it. And a phenomenon that occurred at a certain point was that people are sleeping all day and night, or occupying a park and sleeping at night in the park. Where are they going to get their food from? So many people called up local restaurants in the area around Zuccotti Park and ordered meals to be sent to the occupiers. They ordered them on their credit cards. Now, this was a very good gesture and something that was positive, but then you step back and you say, but wait a minute, not that these people are the exploiters and oppressors on the big scale or anything, but where did the wealth come from that's in circulation that's represented by their credit cards? It exists within the context of and on the foundation, once again, as in Rome, of a whole system of plunder, exploitation, and oppression. And if you don't do away with that system, then all you can do is have a marginal effect while, as we put it, the machinery of capitalism, imperialism, continues humming in the background on a massive scale, destroying lives and crushing spirits all over the world. Because under this system of capitalism, imperialism, the whole functioning of things rests on production carried out through a vast network of exploitation and oppression, including brutal exploitation of hundreds of millions of children in the third world, working 12, 16 hours a day in jobs which are stealing not only their youth, but their lives. And all this must be radically changed in order to have the basis to uproot and eliminate the howling disparities and vast inequalities that mark this world, and the tremendous suffering that this involves for the great majority of humanity. So let's look further at why it has become possible to have a truly world historic transformation in this era of history on the foundation of the development of human society up to this point. Once again, not how human society was bound to develop, but how it actually has developed. If you walk out the door and look at the world, you will see there is tremendous abundance in the world and the potential in the technology and knowledge that exists for even much greater abundance. But you will also see that this is marked by a tremendous lopsidedness, where not only within particular countries, but even more on a world scale, there is a great gap between what a relatively small number of people have and what is left for the great majority of humanity that has produced this wealth in the first place. If we were somehow able to take all of this abundance and all of this technology all at once, we would be able to immediately put an end to those 10 million, not put an end to the children, put an end to the 10 million deaths that putting an end to those 10 million children in the third world. We would be able to immediately feed and clothe and provide a decent life for every person on the planet Earth. The reason this is not happening is, once again, because that's not the way this system works. It produces abundance, but it produces through a system where millions, hundreds of millions, and ultimately billions of people create the wealth, but it's appropriated by a small handful that has previously appropriated to itself the means to produce wealth, the land, technology, raw material, and so on. And this is the great contradiction that's at the heart of what goes on in the world today, that we have the private appropriation of wealth that is socially produced increasingly on a globalized scale by millions, ultimately hundreds of millions, and even billions of people. Now, abundance is important. It's important not only to meet people's material needs, but if you want to have a society where all the inequalities and oppressive relations that we are told are just the natural order of things are actually put an end to, you have to have an abundance. You have to work to create an abundance so that under those conditions of abundance, every human being only needs to spend a few hours a day working to reproduce and even expand the material resources of society, and people can spend the rest of the time in other pursuits, intellectual pursuits, cultural pursuits, just entertaining themselves, sitting around doing nothing. If you don't have those kind of conditions, you will not be able to overcome a situation we have where we have now, where there is great abundance, but given the dynamics of the system we're caught up in, only a relatively small number of people can engage in those pursuits, like working with ideas or organizing and managing things, and the rest of humanity has to work like the bees in the hive or like worker ants while that small number is able to engage in those kinds of activities. This is what we have to be aiming for, but it takes a revolution, a complicated revolution, going through stages and conquering different parts of the world now then and now there in order to be able to get to that point. We need a communist revolution with the final goal of communism throughout the entire world. We need to put an end to the tremendous waste and destruction that's involved in this system. Often we don't think about this. Not only, I'm not just talking about the wars where they blow up things and blow up people. I'm talking about the fact that this system repeatedly denies people even the ability to live and the ability to utilize their creativity and innovativeness to contribute to society. How many hundreds of millions of people are out of work right now in the world under this system? Think of a tremendous waste of human potential just involved in that. Think of all the youth in the inner city of these countries who could be using their creativity and innovativeness to contribute to the betterment of human society and the further emancipation of humanity. Think of the youth in Spain. A few years ago, Spain was considered to be a thriving capitalist country. Do you know that today, for people under 25, 50% are unemployed, and for the country as a whole, 30% are out of work? Think of the waste of humanity involved in that, caused entirely by the workings of this system. It's not like these people don't have the capacity to do things, to contribute in many ways to society. It's they're denied the ability to do that by the workings of this system. And this is what we need to put an end to by transforming society and advancing to communism. There has been a tremendous development of knowledge among human beings, of productive potential, of technology, but it's all monopolized by a small handful in rivalry with each other, and it leads to this tremendous waste and destruction. But despite all this, and in the context of all this, there is now, for the first time in the historical development of human society, the basis on which people oppressed in many different forms, and people truly seeking an end to oppression in all parts of the world, can actually unite, as they could not do in the past, to deal with the real problem and aim, in fact, for the abolition of all relations and all forms of oppression and exploitation. This is the great truth, a profound truth with this system, and those who rule in this system cover over and work to keep people from even seeing the truth, the profound truth that it does not have to be this way. A radically different and much better world really is possible. Now, to bring that world into being, we need a revolution, a real revolution. This system cannot be reformed. It cannot be changed from within to make it serve the interests of the masses of humanity. Its hold over people and over society must be broken. It must be swept aside and a whole new system brought into being. It most definitely, to go back to the very beginning, is not a matter of electing good politicians or better politicians under this system, or making our democracy work better, or making it work for everybody. It is a matter of recognizing that the democracy that exists works just as it is supposed to work, as a cover and at the same time a form through which the capitalist system of exploitation and oppression is maintained and enforced. The following three sentences concentrate an important understanding about all this. In a world marked by profound inequalities and divisions, to talk about democracy without talking about the class nature of that democracy and which class it serves is meaningless and worse. So long as society is divided into classes, there can be no democracy for all. One class or another will rule, and it will uphold and promote that kind of democracy which serves its interests and goals. The question is which class will rule, and whether its rule and its system of democracy will serve the continuation or the eventual abolition of class divisions and the corresponding relations of exploitation, oppression, and inequality. And to this we can add the following two sentences, also from Basics. The essence of what exists in the U.S. is not democracy, but capitalism, imperialism, and political structures to enforce that capitalism, imperialism. What the U.S. spreads around the world is not democracy, but imperialism and political structures to enforce that imperialism. Today, the profound inequalities and oppressive divisions that are embodied in and enforced by this capitalist imperialist system find expression above all on a worldwide scale. And the poverty and brutality that is daily life for literally tens of millions of people within the U.S. itself, as terrible as that really is even much worse for hundreds of millions, indeed billions of people, particularly in the third world. The way forward out of all this, once again, lies in the communist revolution. It's a revolution that transforms the economy, the social relations, for example, the oppressive relations between men and women or between different nationalities or races, as they're sometimes called, which transforms what is now an oppressive division between those relative few who work with ideas and the great masses who are locked out of that and forced to indulge only in physical labor in order to survive, and the transformation of all the ideas that go along with and reinforce the exploitive division into different classes and the oppressive relations that go along with that.
Welcome back. Once again, that was an excerpt from B.A. Speaks' Revolution, Nothing Less, and that's taken from a talk he gave in the end of 2012. And basically, you want to hear the whole speech. It's a really remarkable speech. It's three discs, and if you go to revcom.us and go on the Bob Avakian tab, you can find it right up in there, all right? The thing is called B.A. Speaks' Revolution, Nothing Less, Bob Avakian Live. All right, that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank everybody who worked on the show today, my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board offer today, Kiana Williams, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with No Nazi's Friend from the Dicks. Talk to you again next week.